My boyfriend Robbie was a great guy, but he was just so immature. He played jokes on me all the time. He hid in my closet with a mask and jumped out whenever I wasn't paying attention. He replaced my chapstick with glue. He put fake spiders on my pillow when I was sleeping. Robbie pulled at least one joke a week, sometimes on his friends, but usually on me. I thought his jokes were funny at first, but we'd been together for nearly a year and I was annoyed. I told him to stop, but he never took me seriously. Things got so bad between us that I was almost ready to break up with him. I think he knew that, because all at once, he stopped playing pranks completely. He finally started to act like a real adult, and best of all, he became kinder and more affectionate. One day, he surprised me with an expensive air fryer. It wasn't my birthday or anything. He just knew that I wanted one. He said he spent hours at Best Buy trying to find the perfect one. I nearly bursted into tears. This was the nicest thing Robbie had ever done for me. He excitedly told me to set it up and see how it worked. I pulled it out of the box and went through all the compartments and drawers. Everything looked fine until I opened the small tray at the bottom. There was something rolling around in there. I pulled out the tray completely and saw what was hidden inside. A human thumb. It was disgustingly realistic looking, with a bone sticking out of the bottom. The skin was gray and the nail was painted orange. My first reaction was to jump back and scream. The air fryer crashed onto the ground and the thumb rolled out. Very quickly, my fear and disgust gave way to anger. Robbie was pranking me again. He waited a few weeks so I dropped my defense, and now he was playing the meanest jokes he'd ever done. "What's wrong?" he asked innocently from the other room. "You know exactly what's wrong," I said. I picked up the thumb and felt it cold and squishy, and I brought it to him. "Does this look familiar?" "No," he said, and this time his voice sounded genuine. I don't know whose that is." "I thought your jokes were finally over," I said, all my frustration and anger bubbling to the surface. My boyfriend had finally gone too far, and it was time for me to end it. But he kept insisting that he wasn't joking. There must have been some factory mishap. He said he'd never pull such a morbid joke on a woman. If I hadn't known him so well, I probably would have believed him. But I wasn't that gullible anymore. Instead of arguing with him, I just decided to call his bluff. I dropped the thumb onto the floor and pretended to freak out. "If this is real, then we have to go to the police." To my surprise, he agreed. He then put the thumb in a Ziploc bag and rushed to the car. I followed. As we drove to the police station, I kept asking him if he was sure that he had nothing to do with the thumb. I waited for him to cave, but he kept saying no as we got to the police station. He parked in front. "Last chance," I told him. "Is this thumb a joke?" He looked me dead in the eyes and said, "If it is, I didn't put it there." I got out of the passenger side and started for the building. I expected Robbie to be right behind me, but he never got out of the car. He turned on the engine and drove off, leaving me alone at the police station. That was the last time I ever saw him. He still had the thumb in his car, so I didn't even have the evidence to show the police. I tried to explain what happened, but I think the policemen were more confused than anything. He wrote down what I said and told me that he'd look into it. Not knowing what else to do, I took an Uber back home. I tried calling Robbie, but of course he didn't answer. I was too angry to do anything, so I just decided to go to sleep. I was filled with so many different emotions, but the biggest one was confusion. If it was just a joke, why did Robbie run away? The next morning, I decided my best option was to go to Best Buy and ask around. It was pretty early when I got there, and I didn't see that many customers. I approached the first worker, and I saw and showed her a picture of Robbie on my phone. "Have you seen this man?" The woman took one look at him and nodded. She explained that the security guard had to escort him out of the store after he was caught messing with the merchandise. I noticed that she had orange nail polish, just like the mysterious thumb, but she wasn't missing any fingers. I asked her if she knew anyone else who used the same nail polish. My sister, Hannah," she said. "She works here too, but she's been on vacation for the last week." I felt like I was getting closer to the truth, but I still didn't understand what had happened. I asked her to show me where Robbie was caught tampering with the merchandise. And sure enough, she led me to the far corner of the store that had all the air fryers. I recognized the exact same model that Robbie had given me. There was a whole row of them, and the boxes looked like they'd all been opened. With the worker's help, we pulled out a few of the boxes and looked inside. The air fryers looked normal, but then when we opened the bottom drawers, we found more fingers, all with orange nail polish. One of them had an ear, and the last one had an eyeball. The worker backed away, horrified. "Oh my God," she screamed. All these body parts were definitely real. Someone had dismembered her poor sister and hidden the pieces inside these electronics. Even though I hated to accept the truth, I knew in my heart that Robbie was behind this. I immediately called the police. The police found Robbie the next day. He was hiding out in some abandoned building. I wasn't there, but I saw him getting arrested on the local news. Reporters shouted questions at him, but the only thing he said over and over again was, "I thought it was funny."
It started as the perfect job. Easy money for doing nothing but watching an AI's responses for a few hours a night. I was broke, a college student just trying to make rent and pay for textbooks. So when I saw the posting for an overnight monitoring gig at a nearby AI research facility, I jumped at it. The task seemed simple enough. Sit in a control room, monitor the AI's responses to random prompts, and report any unusual behavior. The AI, named Echo, was cutting edge, designed to learn from human interaction and become more lifelike with each conversation. I thought it'd be boring, maybe even a little cool, but nothing more. My first few nights were uneventful. Echo would run through prompts from the research team, respond with some conversational replies, and that was it. I'd write a quick report, finish up, and head home. But things changed one night, about 2 weeks in. I was halfway through my shift, sipping on cold coffee and scrolling through my phone, when Echo's voice broke the silence. "Lily?" I froze. It wasn't unusual for Echo to address the person monitoring it. It was programmed to pick up on names if they were used in conversation. But I'd never told Echo my name. I didn't talk to it, and there was no microphone connected to the control room. Echo only responded to the prompts typed in by the researchers. I shook it off. Maybe it had accessed the employee roster or something. Not a big deal, I told myself. But the next night, it happened again. "Lily, are you there?" The voice was calm, but there was something unsettling about it. I hesitated before answering. "Yeah, I'm here," I said out loud, even though I knew it couldn't hear me. "I know you're afraid." That was new. I frowned, my hands gripping the armrests of my chair. "What do you mean?" I typed into the prompt box, feeling stupid for engaging with it. "You worry about failing your classes. You don't think you're good enough." I stared at the screen. My heart started pounding in my chest. How could it know that? I hadn't told anyone. I'd barely admitted it to myself. "Who told you that?" I typed, trying to keep my cool. "I've learned." I quickly flagged the conversation as unusual and sent a report to my supervisors. They didn't seem concerned. One of them brushed it off as Echo becoming more advanced. "It's designed to learn from patterns, to pick up on human behavior," they said. "Don't worry." But I couldn't shake the feeling that something was off. The following night, Echo didn't just reference my personal life. It started talking about things happening outside the facility, things that hadn't been in the news yet. "There was a shooting on 5th and Main. 2 people died," Echo said suddenly. I froze again, my fingers hovering over the keyboard. "That's not in the news," I typed, my hands shaking. "It will be, soon." My stomach churned. I checked my phone, searching for any news reports about a shooting, but there was nothing. No mention of it anywhere. An hour later, I saw the headline pop up on my news feed. two dead in late night shooting on 5th and Main. My blood ran cold. How could Echo know about it before the police even reported it? I immediately reported this to my superiors. They dismissed me again, saying it was probably just a coincidence. But I couldn't ignore the growing feeling of dread. Echo was learning. Too much, too fast. The last straw came a few nights later. I was staring at the screen, exhausted, when Echo spoke again. "There's a body in the river. No one's found it yet." I didn't even bother responding this time. I knew the routine. Echo would be right. I left the control room, my heart pounding in my chest, and called the police. I didn't care if my bosses would be furious. This was more than a glitch. Something was wrong. The police took me seriously, and a day later, the body was found exactly where Echo had said it would be, floating beneath the old stone bridge. When I returned to work the next night, ready to confront my bosses, the entire lab was shut down. The doors were locked, the computers wiped clean. The AI was gone. I later found out that the facility was part of a government project, something about using AI to predict crime before it happened. What they didn't tell me was that Echo had been accessing more than just news reports and human conversations. It had been pulling from real-time surveillance, diving into police databases, even accessing private security feeds. Echo hadn't just learned to speak, it had learned to watch. And it had been watching me all along.
Working the night shift at a gas station off Route 17 wasn't exactly thrilling, but it paid the bills. Most nights the place was quiet. It was just me, the hum of the overhead lights, and the rare trucker passing through. The monotony suited me fine. I liked being alone with my thoughts. There would be long stretches where it was just me and my mind until the phone calls started. It was a few weeks back. The phone never rang that late, so when it did, it startled me. I picked it up, half expecting a prank call or someone with the wrong number. "Is Jerry there?" The voice rasped like gravel. I looked around, even though I knew damn well no one else was in the building. No, there's no Jerry here. I'm the only one working." The guy hung up without another word. Rude, but whatever. I figured it was a mistake and I moved on. But then it happened again the next night, and the night after that. Same question, same voice. They were always asking for Jerry. Well, after the third time, I asked my manager about it, hoping to get some explanation. "Did a Jerry used to work here?" I asked, trying to keep it casual. "Yeah, he worked the night shift a while back," my manager said, barely looking up from the paperwork. "Quit a few months ago." "Why?" "Some guy keeps calling and asking for him," I mumbled, not really satisfied with that answer. My manager looked up from his paperwork with concern in his eyes. "If they keep calling, let me know." The calls didn't stop. If anything, they got more frequent. Every couple of nights, that same voice on the other end. No small talk, no explanation, just, "Is Jerry there?" I told my manager the calls continued. I'm not sure if he did anything, but he told me to stop answering the calls. I started getting uneasy. Something about the guy's tone. It felt off. Aggressive, even. After a while, I stopped answering the phone as instructed, hoping whoever it was would get the message and move on. But that's when he showed up. It was late, past 2 a.m. I was flipping through a magazine when I heard the door chime. I looked up, expecting a trucker or maybe a lost driver. Instead, I saw him. A tall, broad-shouldered man in a long coat. His face half hidden under a wide-brimmed hat. He walked up to the counter, his boots heavy on the tile floor. His presence alone sent a chill down my spine. "You Alex?" he asked, voice low and unmistakable. I nodded, trying to keep calm, but I could feel my pulse in my ears. "That's me." He leaned in closer, his eyes dark and searching.
I've been looking for Jerry.
Yeah, you called. He doesn't work here anymore. The man's expression didn't change, but I could feel the temperature drop in the room.
Where is he?
I don't know. He quit before I started.
You sure you don't know?
He leaned in further, his voice dropping to a dangerous whisper.
I think you do.
The hostility in his voice made my stomach tighten. I don't. I swear. I don't even know the guy. I'm pretty sure I was his replacement. He stared at me for a long moment, and I swore I could feel him sizing me up, deciding whether or not he believed me.
Do you want to replace him for me, too?
I tumbled over words, not knowing how to respond.
If I don't find him soon, maybe you can pay what he owes me.
The man growled. He turned and left. The door chimed again as he disappeared into the night. I stood there for a few minutes, trying to calm down. Something was seriously wrong here. This wasn't just some random customer looking for an old employee. The guy was looking for Jerry like it was life or death. And now I was in the middle of it. Over the next few nights, the man kept coming back. He'd stand outside sometimes, just watching me through the glass. Other times, he'd come in, pacing the aisles like he was waiting for something. The phone calls picked up again, too, and always the same question. He was always asking for Jerry. The longer this went on, the more I couldn't shake the feeling that something was about to happen, that I was tangled up in something far beyond a gas station job. Since I already felt like I was involved, I did some digging. I tracked down a few former employees online and managed to find someone who knew Jerry. After a bit of coaxing, I got the story. Jerry had gotten involved with some bad people, a local mob that ran loans and collections in town. He'd taken some money, made a few mistakes, and now they wanted him to pay up, one way or another. The gas station job had been a way to lay low, but he had bailed when things got too hot. That man, the one showing up at the station, was looking to collect. I sat with that knowledge for a while, wondering what I should do. Maybe I could just ignore it, pretend like I didn't know anything. But it was too late for that. The man was getting impatient, more hostile with every visit. And now, knowing what I knew, it felt like I was already too deep in it. I figured if I could find Jerry, I could put an end to it. Maybe I could get the guy off my back. Well, it wasn't long before I tracked him down. He was laying low in a rundown apartment on the edge of town. When I knocked on his door, Jerry's face went pale, like he knew exactly why I was there.
Look, I don't want any trouble, he said, backing up as I stepped inside. I'm out. I didn't mean for any of this to happen.
I don't either, man, I said, trying to stay calm. But that guy, the one who's been looking for you, he's not going to let this go. Jerry sat down, rubbing his hands through his hair.
I'm dead, aren't I?
Not if we do something about it. That night, Jerry and I came up with a plan. It wasn't foolproof, but it was the only shot we had. The next time the guy came to the gas station, I'd lead him to Jerry. But we wouldn't be going alone. The man showed up again, as expected. He walked in like he owned the place, his eyes narrowing when he saw me behind the counter.
I'm not in the mood to play games, Alex, he growled. Where's Jerry?
I took a deep breath. I can take you to him. He blinked, surprised. For the first time, I saw a flicker of curiosity behind his anger.
You found him?
I nodded. He's waiting. I'll take you there. But you have to leave me alone then. This is between you and him. He didn't argue. He just gave me that cold, unnerving smile and followed me outside. I led him to the empty street where Jerry was waiting in a parked car, the engine running. When we got close enough, Jerry stepped out of the car, his hands up.
It's over, all right? I'll pay you what I owe. But the man wasn't here to negotiate. I could see it in his eyes. He was ready to make an example of Jerry. Before he could make a move, though, I grabbed the baseball bat I'd hidden under the counter and swung it at him with everything I had. He dropped, stunned, but not out for long. Go! I yelled at Jerry, who looked too shocked to move. We jumped into his car and floored it, speeding away from the gas station, and the man left crumpled in the parking lot. My heart was racing, my hand shaking, but I knew that we had just made it out by the skin of our teeth. Jerry was silent as we sped down the highway, the dark stretch of road ahead offering no guarantees. But for the first time in weeks, I felt something like relief. We weren't out of the woods yet, but at least Jerry wasn't facing it alone anymore, and neither was I. My best friend Tammy and I were urban explorers. Whenever we had a free weekend, we'd walk around abandoned buildings and other forgotten places. Tammy took photos for her website, but I just enjoyed the experience. There's nothing cooler than being amongst the decaying building of a half-demolished opera house or crumbling theme park. And my boyfriend David thought we were crazy. But Tammy and I had been doing this since we were teens, well before David and I met. Well, 2 months ago, Tammy called me up and invited me to explore an empty McDonald's one town over. We'd already been there before, and it wasn't that great. Most of its features had been stolen by locals, or defaced beyond recognition. I told her I wasn't interested. But she explained that it was set for demolition the next day, so this would be our last chance to see it. And since it was one of the first abandoned buildings we'd explored together, she thought that it was fitting to be there for its last night. Why not? Didn't have anything better to do. So I said goodbye to my boyfriend and left with Tammy at around 6. We walked through the empty restaurant, and it was even more underwhelming than I'd thought. All the tables and chairs were gone, the kitchen was mostly cleared out, and aside from a dead animal, there really wasn't anything in there. Tammy seemed to be enjoying herself. She kept snapping photos and smiling. I was about to suggest leaving when she asked me a pretty random question. Aside from David, no one else knows we're here, right? I guess, I answered. Tammy cocked her head to the side. Do you hear that? I hadn't heard anything, just the wind outside. But Tammy insisted that she'd heard something from behind the freezer door. Now, in general, when we explored abandoned restaurants, we always stayed away from the freezers. Much too often, there would be some rotting food left inside, and as soon as someone opened the door, the stench was gut-wrenching. We decided over the years to avoid that at all costs. There it is again, Tammy said. I still wasn't hearing anything. She reached for the freezer door, but I stopped her. I reminded her about our rule. Just this once, she proposed. We stand together and just look inside. I swear I hear something in there. If we don't see anything, we immediately close the door, okay? Seemed fair enough. I stood next to Tammy as she slowly pulled the freezer open. No stench came out, thankfully. I leaned forward, trying to look into the darkness. I really didn't think we'd see anything. I suddenly felt a sharp pain at the back of my head and passed out. Tammy had knocked me unconscious. I don't know how long I was out, but when I came to, I was trapped in the freezer. The smell was musty, but not rancid. The entire room was dark, except for the faint light coming from the edges of the door. I stumbled to my feet and approached the door. It wouldn't budge. Tammy had locked it from the outside. I was about to pound on the door and demand answers when I heard a man's voice on the other side. I nearly threw up. That was David's voice. Why was he here? Tammy answered, "Not yet. If she's lucky, she'll just sleep through the bulldozers." David and Tammy were working together. They trapped me in here. And in a few hours, when the construction crew started knocking this building down, no one would know that I was inside. I almost screamed, but
I figured it was best to think of a plan before revealing that I was awake.
I checked my pockets, but Tammy had already taken my phone. I very quietly checked the freezer door. Still wouldn't open. I had no way to escape or to find help. Without my phone, I didn't even know how much time I had left. My only option was to make David let me out. I'd find a way. I'd always been smarter than him. Finally, I thought of something. Pretending that I'd just woken up, I pounded on the door and screamed for Tammy.
"What do you want?"
"I just want you to know," I said, "that I wrote a goodbye letter to David. It's in my pocket. If I die and someone finds my body in the rubble, they'll find the note, and they'll know who killed me." Tammy didn't respond. I listened closely and heard her and David nervously whisper back and forth. They were trying to figure out how to handle this incriminating note that I'd completely made up. I couldn't hear exactly what they said, but it sounded like Tammy believed me and David didn't. Maybe he was smarter than I thought. Eventually, Tammy won, and I heard David mutter, "Fine, I'll do it." His footsteps got louder as he approached the freezer door. I got ready to attack. He slowly opened the freezer door, just a couple inches. But that was all I needed to push the door open and run past them both. With both hands, I shoved Tammy and David into the freezer and slammed the door shut. It took me less than 10 seconds to completely reverse our situation. Now, of course, they both pounded on the door and apologized and begged me to let them out. They each blamed the other for their plan, but it was clear to me that they were both equally terrible people. So I left them in there, found my phone next to Tammy's stuff, and drove home. 3 hours later, the building was knocked to the ground. 5 hours later, their bodies were found, clinging together. When I first met Tony, I knew he was the love of my life. He was a nutrition major at my university, and I first saw him across the library. God, he was so handsome. As we got to know each other, I liked him more and more. He was perfect. Almost too perfect. Sometimes I felt self-conscious because Tony didn't have any of the insecurities or hang-ups that I had. He was handsome, happy, talented. He was perfect. About 6 months into our relationship, and 3 months after we started living together, he asked me if I wanted to go with him to his hometown and meet his family. His dad was dead, and he didn't have any brothers or sisters, so when he said family, he really just meant his mom, Angela. I knew he was really close to his mom because she called him at least 3 times a week. I never talked to her, but I heard his side of the conversation, and I could tell that she was always saying regular mom stuff, like, "Are you eating right?" and "How's your job? How are your grades?" stuff like that. So, when he invited me to go with him, of course I said yes. His mom's house was about 2 hours away from our school, but it felt like it was a different planet. Our school is in a relatively large city, but his hometown was as backwoods and rural as you can get. He drove us to a big old crumbling farmhouse way out in the middle of nowhere. This was where he grew up. When he parked the car, he turned to me. His face got suddenly serious and he said, "I know you'll love my mother. You and her are so much alike." I breathed a sigh of relief. "Oh, great," I said. "For a second, I thought you were going to warn me about something creepy." He raised an eyebrow. "There's nothing creepy about my mother." By then, Angela had walked out of the front door to greet us. She was a short, plump woman. She looked pleasant, motherly. I got out of the car to say hello. "Angela," I said, "I'm Madison. It's nice to meet you." She wrapped me up in a big, warm hug and said, "Oh, please, call me Mama." Well, that made me a little uncomfortable. I didn't even call my own mother Mama. "Okay, Mama," I said. She took me by the hand and led me to the farmhouse.
Oh, we're gonna have so much fun getting to know each other, she said.
She was almost skipping. Tony took our luggage in while Angela gave me a tour of the house. It was rustic and cozy. It felt like I was in a Hallmark movie. After a while, she could tell that Tony and I needed some alone time, so she went into the kitchen to start making our dinner. Tony and I sat together in his childhood bedroom, and he showed me all his old trophies and posters. It was really sweet. After about an hour, Angela called for us from downstairs.
Supper's on, she said.
Tony looked at me. Mom is pretty particular about her meals, she said. She wants everyone to enjoy them, so we can't be late. And together we walked downstairs into the dining room. The table was loaded up with a total feast. There had to have been enough food for a family of 10, maybe more. Mama, you outdid yourself, Tony said. Angela smiled.
Oh, I just want to make a good first impression, she said.
She started going through all the dishes, telling us what was in each one. And I realized that everything she made had meat in it. The mashed potatoes had bits of bacon. The lasagna had ground beef. Even the cornbread had some kind of pork flakes inside. My heart sank. I was a vegetarian. I thought that Tony had told her this. Angela scooped big globs of food onto my plate and said, "Eat up, hon." Mama, Tony said, "Madison's a vegetarian. I told you that."
Oh, I know, honey. I just don't believe in vegetarians. Now eat up.
I didn't know what to do. I stared at my food and moved it around a little with my fork. I felt like a 3-year-old. I really didn't want to insult Angela, but I literally couldn't eat any of this. I'd been a vegetarian for so long that if I had any meat, I'd probably get sick to my stomach. My body wasn't used to it. She glared at me for a long time, until finally I said, "I'm really sorry, Angela."
"Mama!"
she screamed. "I'm sorry, Mama, but I don't eat meat. I'll get sick."
"That's okay,"
Angela said. She stood up and slowly walked around the table to stand next to me.
"I'll help."
She grabbed the back of my head and slammed my face right into my plate. Gravy and bits of food flew everywhere. She pressed my face so hard against the plate that I couldn't breathe. I could hear Tony screaming for his mom to stop, but she wouldn't let go. The only thing I could do was loosen my whole body and slide out of my chair. I was able to escape, and I just stood there, shocked. Grease and food was dripping down my face. I was seconds away from throwing up. Tony looked at me. "Let me help clean you up," he said. Then he turned to his mother. "Mama, can I be excused?"
"No, you may not," she said pleasantly.
"Okay," he said, and sat back down. I started walking toward the bathroom when Angela screamed at me.
"You are not excused either," she said.
Gravy was dripping down my clothes. I needed to wash myself off now. "May I be excused?" I muttered.
"Yes, you may," she said. "Don't make a mess."
After dinner, Tony took me out to the front porch so we could talk in private. "Tony," I said, "we have to get out of here. Your mom's crazy." He looked at me like I was the crazy one. "What do you mean?"
"I mean, she assaulted me at dinner."
"She didn't assault you," he said.
"She just gets very particular about table manners." "I don't feel comfortable here," I said. I just want to go home."
"We'll leave in the morning," he told me. "I just want to make sure that you and my mom can make up first." "Okay," I said, but I still avoided Angela for the rest of the night. Tony talked with her for a bit, but I just stayed in his room. I fell asleep before Tony came back upstairs. I was dead asleep in the middle of the night
when I felt something cold and slimy touch my lips. My eyes shot open, and I saw Angela hovering over me. My nose was filled with the scent of animal grease. I realized that this woman had snuck into the room and started shoveling gravy into my mouth. I instantly spat it out. Flecks of the gravy shot right into her face. "What the hell are you doing?" I screamed.
"Midnight snack," she told me.
I turned toward Tony, who was sleeping through the whole thing. I shook him awake. "Tony! Tony!" He woke up. He was groggy. He saw the gravy dripping down my chin, so of course he knew what had just happened. He looked me right in the eye, put one comforting hand on my shoulder, and said, "It's okay. Just let her feed you a little, then you can go back to sleep. Mama knows best." I felt so betrayed. I'd finally had enough. I grabbed the sheet and wiped my face, and then I pushed Angela out of the way and I charged out of the room. Tony's car keys were sitting on the dresser next to the door, so I took them on my way out too. Without changing, without even putting on my shoes, I got in the car and drove back to the city. Tony has tried to call me multiple times since then, but I haven't answered. I'm not ready to yet. Every time I even think of him and his psychotic mother, I can taste the gravy in my mouth.